Good morning. Grace and peace to you this morning. Our reading from the Gospel of Matthew is Matthew chapter 5, verses 1 through 12. Matthew chapter 5, verses 1 through 12. It is on page 4, 3 and 4 of our Pew Bibles. Matthew chapter 5, verses 1 through 12. And when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain. After he sat down, his disciples came to him. Then he began to speak and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." As the Sermon on the Mount begins, we must understand its placement within the Gospel of Matthew. In Matthew chapter 1, Jesus has been born and designated the true King of the Jews and the true Son of Abraham. In Matthew chapter 2, Jesus, just like Israel at the end of Genesis, sojourns in Egypt before settling in the land of Israel. In Matthew 3, Jesus, just like Israel before him, crosses the Jordan River, where Jesus is simultaneously anointed as the King of the Jews. In Matthew 4, Jesus goes on to the wilderness, where he is tempted just like Israel was. One of the things Matthew stresses over and over in these first four chapters is that Jesus succeeds where Israel failed. It is at the end of Matthew 4 that after Jesus discovers that John the Baptizer has been imprisoned, that Jesus begins to heal every sickness and every disease of the people and to proclaim the gospel of the kingdom. It is this gospel of the kingdom on which Jesus extrapolates in the Sermon on the Mount. As the Sermon on the Mount begins, Matthew says that Jesus goes up on a mountain and he sat down. At this point, his disciples came to him. Now, initially, as we read this passage, we don't know whether this is a positive or a negative thing. Is Jesus attempting to get some personal time? Is he attempting to flee from the crowds? It's only in verse 2 that we see that Jesus uses this as an opportunity to teach the disciples. It is important to note that Matthew is probably once again using Old Testament imagery to describe Jesus. In Exodus 19, Moses goes up on the mountain of God, Sinai, to retrieve the law from God. Matthew is therefore portraying Jesus in a similar manner, as the new authoritative teacher and expositor of God's law. Just as God spoke through Moses on a mountain, similarly, God is now speaking through Jesus on a mountain. This teaching aspect of Jesus' ministry is stressed by Matthew, but lost in our English translations. The verb that Matthew uses to describe Jesus' teaching has a progressive element to it. I think what Matthew is trying to tell us is what Jesus began to teach and continued to teach in a similar manner. The first words from Jesus' mouth are what we call the Beatitudes. The first question we may ask, and I think should ask, is what in the world is a Beatitude? Beatitudes were somewhat common in ancient Judaism, and they were tools that ancient Jewish teachers used to instruct their students. They usually reflected some sort of wisdom and the ways in which God's people could live out God's laws. For example, the same word used by Matthew and Jesus to describe blessed or happy throughout the Beatitudes is used in the first psalm. There the psalmist notes, happy or blessed are those who do not follow the advice of the wicked, or take the path that sinners tread, or sit in the seat of scoffers. But their delight is in the law of the Lord, and in God's law they meditate day and night. This beatitude was used to encourage ancient Jews on the necessity of meditating upon God's instructions for them in the first five books of the Bible. As we turn back to the Beatitudes, we notice first and foremost, as Cooper has already brought to our attention, how countercultural these Beatitudes are. The people who are to be considered blessed or happy are the very people whom most of society would not expect. Thus, Jesus' Beatitudes are really about the great divine reversal of the gospel of the kingdom. That the Beatitudes reflect the definition of what the gospel of the kingdom is clear in that at the conclusion of the first Beatitude in 5:3 and the eighth Beatitude, the phrase, the kingdom of heaven, appears. The next thing we should notice about the Beatitudes is their purpose. Being a Beatitude, their purpose is to provide instruction. But it is the manner in which they provide instruction that makes them significant, and the instruction of some of them that are remarkable. With regard to the topic of the instruction they provide, the Beatitudes are very much anchored in what is called an apocalyptic worldview that has all but vanished today. For Jesus, for Paul, for the first Christians, and for some great leaders in churches of Christ, such as David Lipscomb and James Harding, history was rapidly drawing to its conclusion, and God's intervention, judgment, and transformation of the world was imminent. Thus, the Beatitudes reflect the perspective that the telos, or the culmination of the world, would soon arrive in the lives of the believers in the first century CE. Concerning the instruction of some of the Beatitudes, they really function to provide hope and to comfort the poor by dividing the Beatitudes into two parts. Jesus accomplishes this hope and comfort by noting the present situation of believers, not only of his day, but also certainly of those people who would have received Matthew's gospel originally. While the second part of the Beatitudes talks about the imminent future. This division success suggests that Christianity, at least from Jesus's and Matthew's perspectives, was not meant to be the health and wealth gospel it's come to be. On the contrary, Christianity was, and I think still is, a religion for the poor, for the helpless, and for the persecuted who would receive blessings only available in the next life. The next observation about the Beatitudes is that these are really speech acts that serve to create and to make God's kingdom present among Jesus's and Matthew's followers. The first three Beatitudes make it clear that Jesus is pronouncing a blessing on the downtrodden and the poor of Jesus's society. Those who are poor in spirit, those who mourn, and those who are meek. Typically, Protestants take these Beatitudes and spiritualize them. The people who are spiritually destitute, it is the people who are spiritually mourning, the people who are spiritually meek to whom Jesus is addressing. And it is these people that need God. However, a lot of first century Jews were not modern day Platonists, and a lot of these people who lived in the areas in which Jesus ministered were truly poor and destitute. In Jewish thinking in the first century, poor in spirit was a metaphor for someone who was lowly. Probably best should be understood as someone who is in a humble state. This humble state included not only poor people, but also the oppressed, the dependent, the humiliated, generally anyone who would be an outcast from society. Moreover, those who mourn and meek are probably people who had something about which to mourn. It was probably people over whom others were lording over. In modern terms, these would be the people who received food stamps, The ones who work at our fast food places, the homeless, the ones who struggle to make ends meet. It is to these people, not the rich, not the powerful, not the privileged, that Jesus says the kingdom, comfort, and the land belong. Like the physically poor, these promises of blessing are materialistic and are meant to occur in the imminent future. While some may question the materialism of inheriting the kingdom and of being comforted, there's no denying that inheriting land is a very materialistic and physical blessing. This may not seem much to us who dwell in a city as large as Boston, but the desire to own and to operate land has always been fundamental for sustaining life, and it transcends time and culture. In one of my favorite novels of Mice and Men, Crooks, the African-American stable hand, makes one of the most profound statements in the entire book and sums up not only the purpose of the book's main characters, but also, I think, of humanity with regard to land throughout the ages. Crooks says, just like heaven, everybody wants a piece of land. I read plenty of books out here. Nobody never gets to heaven, and nobody gets no land. It's just in their head. They're all talking about it, but it's just in their head. I know from my own personal experience the desire to have land. I remember vividly the day in which my father, because of some very bad financial decisions that he made, lost the house and the farm on which I and he grew up. The land that we literally farmed, the land that we poured out blood, sweat, and tears, the woods in which both he and I played as children's, the room in which we both made memories were taken from us. And my father, unfortunately, was homeless for a time. A few years later, before my father died, he shared with me the pain and the torment of losing his childhood home and my future inheritance and of being homeless. And he said that was the lowest point in his life. He even confided in me that he had really thought about taking a shotgun and placing it in his mouth and committing suicide. It is to that kind of person, in that kind of state, to which Jesus says the kingdom of heaven belongs. It is for that kind of person that Jesus says these people will inherit a kingdom. These people will be comforted. And these people will get what they've always wanted, what they can't get because the rich lorded over them. And that's land. These are definitely physical and something about which any poor person in the first century and any poor person today would think was good news. The next part of the Beatitudes focuses more on the behavior of Jesus' audience. Beginning at verse 6 and going through verse 12, Jesus describes the manner in which the people of the kingdom are supposed to behave. Traditionally, like those poor in spirit, Protestants have spiritualized those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. However, this is certainly not correct. In first century Judaism, righteousness was understood really as righteous acts. Now, these righteous acts do not save one. Nevertheless, they are the criterion by which God will judge God's people and the world. Even Paul, the so-called champion of righteousness by faith, says in Romans 2:6, that God will judge every person, both Jew and Greek, according to their actions, according to their behaviors. Thus, the people who hunger and thirst for righteousness are people who are actively pursuing righteous actions and behaviors that God would consider righteous and in keeping with God's covenant with God's people. How else are people to show their mercy unless they offer acts of mercy? Moreover, those who are peacemakers are people who are actively pursuing peace, not those people who passively stumble into it. Think about the correlation between violence and poverty. The two go hand in hand. As a result, Jesus' followers would have had plenty of opportunity to be peacemakers, to stop someone from stealing, to stop someone from killing someone for a piece of bread. The final three verses, verses 10, 11, and 12, indicate that Christians will be and are being persecuted for their beliefs. Thus, the act of being persecuted for Matthew and for Jesus is a sign that one is a believer. It's fascinating that the form that verses 10 and 11 take, there's a dramatic shift. From verses 3 to 10, people are addressed in the third person. It's he, she, they. However, in verses 11 and 12, a second person is addressed in the second person plural, you all. It seems that Jesus is speaking directly in verses 11 and 12 to the community that makes up Matthew's church. What is so fascinating to me about the Beatitudes, and really about the Bible in general, is the lack of explanation why the people to whom Jesus is speaking are poor, why they're persecuted. The closest explanation Jesus provides for anything is in verse 12. And to be honest, that's not much of an explanation, because of my name. Jesus and the first followers, I do not think, were idiots. They knew the world in which they live. They knew that the rich became richer and the poor just became poor. They knew that bad things happened to good people all the time. However, they didn't get an explanation in the Gospel of Matthew, nor that we have on record from Jesus of why these things occurred. But what they are given in Matthew's Beatitudes, and it seems from Jesus, is the most powerful tool that anyone possesses in their toolbox. That's hope. Hope that is grounded in the physical and in the material. Hope of a blessing. Hope of having their own land in which to dwell. The hope of material blessing when the kingdom of God is fully present on earth, that is only available to people, according to Jesus, who are actively, physically poor. And people who are physically and actively pursuing righteousness, peace, and mercy. This morning, I want to challenge us not to spiritualize the Beatitudes as has been done for so many centuries, but for us to think about these things in materialistic and physical terms. I wanted to challenge us this morning to use this week, this coming Lent, to find a way to physically act out the kingdom. I want us to find a way this week and through Lent to physically help those who are poor and downtrodden. To find a way physically to bring a portion of the kingdom to them.